From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state.
Pella Neuroth-Taylor
on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon, the 20th of May. Well, we've got four excellent guests for you today, and the overarching theme, I think, is whether we're going to enter into the age of assassinations, just as we've been in the age of war for the last 2 years. I say that because we've got the attempted assassination of Robert Fico, the peace-loving, in my view, Prime Minister of Slovakia last week. And then we've got the death of the Iranian President Raisi last night in a helicopter crash in northwest Iran. Now, the question is whether that was an accident or whether it was an assassination. Obviously, Israel has been assassinating Iranian scientists for years and did a strike on the Damascus consulate of Iran, killing several top leaders of the Iranian IGRC, I think it was. And according to books, the total death toll of Israeli assassinations down the years are up to, you know, astonishing 1,700 or 2,000. That's according to Ronan Bergman. Google his books if you want on the record account of the Israeli assassination machine. And of course, if it does turn out to be an assassination, it marks significant escalation of that conflict between Iran and Israel, which we thought had been quietened down a little bit after the last month's exchange of missiles and drones. And let's pray that it doesn't mean that. But we are entitled to ask if it's the age of assassinations. Apparently, Vucic, the Serbian prime minister, has been warned that he was under an assassination. And of course, the problem with Robert Fico was that he was aligned himself with a peace development in Europe, which was echoed by Orban, Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, who'd been fighting a lonely fight in the councils of the European Union. And he found an ally with his northern neighbor, the present prime minister of Slovakia. And he has been, he survived this assassination attempt. He's apparently out of danger, but there's been speculation whether the man, the shooter, apparently a 71-year-old poet or writer or something, who was very concerned about the pro-Kremlin views of Robert Fico, may have some Ukrainian connections. But as we said, neither the Russians in the alternative media, nor the alternative media, nor the Western mainstream media have gone anywhere really about this speculation about whether it might be a Ukrainian origins of this plot. But the Ukrainians are certainly getting desperate, and they are losing out on the front lines. And we'll be talking about who's behind the Fico and who's behind the Iran attack, if it was not just a crash into a foggy mountainside. Certainly, the period before World War One, I just put out my revised edition of my World War One book, The War Guilt Question. The period 1907 to 1914 was characterized by a large number of assassinations of political leaders, not just Franz Ferdinand on the cusp of that, but others. And the painfully difficult 1930s, that period before World War II, was also characterized by several high-profile assassinations. And so all these both devastating World Wars, one and two, were preceded by a long period of high tensions and political murders. So we'll see if we're now into an era of political murders, because there's always this danger that an assassination that could be traced to one of the other great powers might set in train an escalation, because that's sort of generally regarded as unacceptable. And Franz Ferdinand, of course, was killed in June 28, 1914, and it was ultimately traced to Serb intelligence. And from there, I think a lot of the early books on World War One actually traced it to Russian intelligence. So people think I just say good things about the Russians. Well, I think that the Russians, maybe Grand Duke Nikolai, who was one of the commanding generals of the Russian side, they wanted an actuating event that would allow them to attack Germany in World War One, with the French attacking from the other side simultaneously, which is actually what happened if you look closely at the scholarship. The Austrians, you know, had to go to war in Serbia, but the Serbs had fired the first shot, as it were, which was the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, and behind that was the Russians. So assassinations can cause world wars, and there's no mistake about that. But I just want to go on to a lighter topic before we enter into our day's interviews. We've got Mats Nilsson, of course, a regular guest from Stockholm. He's going to talk about Mossad and Iran and maybe the latest developments with the ICC. The court case Khan is as going to try and have it both ways, if you like, by putting both the Hamas leaders and Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, in front of the International Criminal Court. If he gets his way, it'll obviously lead to severe reduction in Netanyahu's political possibilities to travel around the world, and as other senior Israeli leaders, it won't matter so much to Hamas since they're already sort of pariahs in much of the West. We've got Christine Hart, who's another returning guest, a friend of mine, private detective and a former investigator working for the tabloids in Britain, and she has a view on the Diana. Princess Diana, who either died in a crash completely by accident, or that too was a political assassination. The tabloids in Britain used to cover this assassination theory quite a lot, actually, back in the 2000s. And there was a time when Piers Morgan was a real journalist, in my view, and went quite far with this. And he's dropped the subject, he's becoming a talk show host and all the rest of it. And the British press haven't really shown any interest in. But I'm quite convinced that Prince Harry and his rather pushy but not unpleasant wife, Meghan, have sort of had this Damoclean sword hanging over the rest of the royal family, because I can't believe that Meghan, with an inquiring mind, doesn't have this theory and all the evidence for it down pat. Well, Christine, who's worked many years on the tabloids and has got good contacts in MI6, will tell us her view on that story of the assassination, if or not. And that would justify or explain why maybe Prince Charles has been given the satanic treatment in a portrait, which I'll talk about in just a moment. Our third guest is Keith Blow, who's a psychiatrist to the stars in America. Famously, he worked for Fox News for a long time. He's written 16 books that have sold millions of copies and translated into 8 languages. But he's been in the news because of his psychiatric advice to Hunter Biden, the son of the president, who has had these huge drug problems. He's apparently clean, but he left one behind one of his laptops in Keith's home, which was then confiscated by the FBI. And we all know about the laptop that was left behind by the drugged president's son in a computer repair shop. And that's what caused this scandal in the up to the last election. But the New York Post wrote about it, but his drug habits and the sort of nude photos and the young women on that computer's hard drive. The rest of the media killed it, and it wasn't allowed on Twitter, the New York Post article, Twitter being a democratic stronghold then. So it could have swayed the election. But anyway, there's a second laptop with interesting information. So Keith will maybe be able to tell us about that. He'll also tell about his recipes for happiness and why psychiatry is important. Psychiatrists haven't always had the best reputation. Finally, we've got Dirk Puhlmann, who is a legend of a journalist, one of Germany's top investigative journalists, always goes where the truth takes him, completely fearless. He's done two dozen documentaries that all highlight a new aspect of reality and our current affairs. And he is extremely experienced, and he'll give his views on the latest developments in Ukraine and in Iran and Israel, maybe. But I just want to hearken back to my topic of last week, which was this satanic portrait of Prince Charles, which if you held up a mirror to it, or if you flipped it, it actually, on the left hand, to the left of Charles's shoulder in this portrait painted by Jonathan Yeo, who's an old school friend of mine, you saw what looked like half a devil's face with the horns and the nose and the mouth and the eyes, okay? And surprisingly, I could see that just by judging by the half of the face. But if you flipped it and added the two together, like a mirror image, it actually, the other half complemented the first half. So you saw devil's face, and then you saw two versions of Charles flipped over. And the pictures on the internet of this. But you have to look, because of this mainstream media, and I think Google probably censor it. So you have to go onto Twitter or X and look for accounts. I think Matt Wallace had a very good account of that. And you can see the original, which is on BBC and everywhere. And it does look like half the devil's face. It's not Photoshopped or anything. It really is like that. So the question is this deliberate or not? I mean, the whole Prince Charles picture, King Charles, is awash with red anyway. It looks satanic even without having seen this sort of devil, huge devil's face in the midst of it. Needless to say, no one in the media, mainstream media, corporate media will even go there. But you have to go to the so-called conspiracy theorists of Twitter to find it. But I just wanted to say this, actually, if Jonathan Yeo was risking having his head cut off metaphorically, he's not the first artist to what we could call Easter eggs. I mean, the term Easter eggs is something that you, a computer programmer or a gamer, usually hides inside a game or a computer code, which is like a signature, a little trick, a little game that the cognoscenti will recognize. And aha, that's like a, you don't notice it immediately, but you'll notice it later. But famous artists, Renaissance artists, have sometimes done this sort of thing. They've left a signature or something that people sometimes only discover hundreds of years later. So there's Giotto, who was a 14th century painter. I'm just going to read here. The famous cycle by the Renaissance painter Giotto in the upper church of the Basilica of St. Francis in Assisi, Death and the Ascension of St. Francis, depicts a subject being laid to rest and carried to heaven. In 2011, medievalist Chiara Fregoni discovered a hidden image located within the cloud of smoke between heaven and earth, a powerful portrait with a hooked nose, sunken eyes, and two dark horns. A devil, in other words. Similarly, and that's no, there's no doubt about it when you see it close up, but I guess people were watching from down below and they couldn't see all that far up in the ceiling. Michelangelo, one of the most famous paintings in history, in the Sistine Chapel, you know, where God the Father is pointing at Adam with his finger. Well, you all know that. Well, apparently, the cloak that surrounds God is in the exact shape, anatomical shape, of a brain. And a physician called Frank Meshberger wrote about this in the Journal of the JAMA, which is one of America's top medical journals, a really serious piece of scholarship. And to me, it's totally convincing that, and in fact, Michelangelo's intention might have been to show that God didn't only give the gift of life to Adam with his sort of zapping Adam by the finger, but also the gift of cognition, gift of the brain. And I think that's, and another, there's a famous Holbein masterpiece, I think, which is the National Gallery in London, where you look in a certain direction and you'll see a huge skull. You have to stand at a certain angle, and that's like a memento mori for those who are standing at an angle to the picture. Again, just Google Holbein and death or something. So, and there are many others. You can just Google Easter egg and artists. So if Jonathan Yeo had planted a magnificent sort of, I don't know, turd on King Charles's reputation, it wouldn't be unprecedented. But then you wonder, would he get away with it? It's a high risk strategy and so on. But anyway, so we're going to, that's that. We're going to talk about more serious topics now. And, but we're going to go our guest, Mats Nilsson, is going to be with us now as we segue into the world events of the Middle East and Ukraine. So we'll be back with him after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Nerols Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back after the break.
TNT's Jason Burmess.
In other words, they would actually have to test your blood. No, they don't have to do that anymore. What do I mean by that? Well, I've often talked about MySight technology, which is Bluetooth-enabled medicine, smart medicines out there. And MySight technology has already been utilized, get this, with a drug treated for depression. So in other words, psychological evaluations. And that drug isn't just for depression. It's called Abilify. It's for depression when you're already prescribed antidepressants don't work. So we're going to put some Abilify on top of that. That is extremely scary. And that is actually happening right now.
Jason Burmess on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to TNTRadio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. Today's News Talk Radio.
Now we're talking. Turn it up. Yeah.
TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelineros Tele Show on this TNT News Talk on this Monday afternoon. We've got Mats Nilsson with us, who's an author and geopolitical analyst, a legal historian and independent thinker. You can find him on Mazze Nilsson on Twitter. And he and I are going to talk about Iran and Middle East and Ukraine and whether we're entering into an age of assassinations. Thanks. Welcome to the show, Mats.
Thank you so much. Once again, things happen so quickly right now. It's
incredible.
You almost dread opening up the news flow in the morning when you wake up. But this latest death in Iran concerning the president is let's just say it's pure speculation about what happened. But I would like to say the one thing that I know is it's going to perhaps test the Iranian system, but it's not in any way going to impact the overall structure or the power of the country's institutions. It's going to have an emotional impact, as any death of a current and sitting leader has on any country, but it's not going to hinder the continuity of governance in Iran that I have seen some people out of the Western think tanks have been speculating on, but I don't agree with them, as so often happens.
Who was Raisi? Do you know? I mean, how did he fit into the Iranian system, and how was he perceived by Iranians and people outside Iran?
Well, it's let's just say that he has been part of Iran's modern history for some time now. I mean, before becoming president, he used to head up the Iranian judiciary, and even though we may both be schooled in law, I would say there is a huge difference between how the Iranian system perceives law and how I perceive law. As you know, it's quite a draconian set of laws that they have in Iran from a Western perspective. But he already at the age of I can't really remember it, but somewhere just in his mid-20s, he became a deputy prosecutor in Tehran. And then he kept climbing on this judicial ladder for many years, and finally ending up as an attorney general in Iran. And before he had to resign, he was the chief of justice in the Iranian high court, or I think they call it the Supreme Court. So, but when he was ahead of the judiciary, he was actually sanctioned by the United States, and he has not won any friends in the West. But that said, I would like everyone to remember that he was trying to negotiate a deal with the United States concerning the Iran nuclear power station futures, and have it what you may. I forgot the vibration of the discussions now, but the Iran nuclear project was under discussion between Raisi and America. So even though he distrusted and was sanctioned by the Americans, he still tried to do diplomacy, and I think that it's one way of looking at this man. He's a hardliner, but he's a hardliner in the sense that he's pragmatic enough to see what the needs of Iran is on the within the foreign policy, because he did quite a lot of work in becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He also joined BRICS, and he was pushing for Iran to become a member of the Eurasian Economic Union. And not to be forgotten, he expanded the relations with Russia many times over during his tenure now as president. So both militarily and economically and bilaterally and within the trade sector, he pushed the Iran agenda, I would say, quite successfully. So but then he did other things that weren't appreciated, and that mainly I'm talking about the strict interpretation of the laws in Iran. He wasn't a reformist in any sense of the word. So from a Western perspective, he probably wasn't the best guy to have around. But I mean, it's that's something, you know, you have different glasses when looking at things. But I would say if you're an Iranian and you look at what he's done for Iran, it was probably for the good concerning the economic and political placing of Iran in the region.
Sometimes it's better to negotiate with hardliners, because from our perspective, Western perspective, because then you know that there'll be nobody to outflank them, you know. So if they offer a deal, you can take it to the bank, and of course they know that as well, and they know their value as hardliners, because everyone is going to be all to the left of them anyway, and they've got credibility, because you know they won't sell out the country because of what are the things that he's done. But anyway, well, that's interesting. And of course he was, I mean, when we think of Iran, apart from the fantastically civilized, long period of civilization, we tend to think of those trucks, those with their cranes and some poor homosexual dangling from it, you know. And I guess that was Raisi's domestic signature. But we're adults, we can separate between leaders good on their own terms for their country and that country's political power and their sort of adherence to domestic or democratic norms. So it's interesting, because I thought he was a social reform. Sorry, yeah, carry on. Yeah.
No, I was just saying it's for me it's an awful way of interpreting the law, and with the death sentences for, as you say, homosexuality. And but we keep forgetting in the West that we're constantly doing business with Saudi Arabia, and when it comes to the set of laws as far as draconian goes with our Western way of looking at it, Saudi Arabia and Iran are basically the same. But I mean, since we in the West can be allies to Saudi Arabia, it's not as if this Iranian laws would hinder us in any way. It's other things that makes us separate between Saudi Arabia and Iran, as you know, and it's called the geopolitical chess game. Iran is bad. Saudi Arabia is also bad, but they're our bad guys, so we accept them. And that's also one for the history
books. By the
way,
thing about homosexuality, I've got a very good friend who's spent decades in the Middle East, in Qatar, and he's quite very homosexual. And he says it goes on just as much there as when he lived in New York, but they don't. So it carry, and he never felt in any trouble or anything. So it's his wit testimony is that it's the persecution isn't as bad as we make it out to be. Anyway, so it's interesting. So it's interesting that he was killed in Northwest, or he died in Northwest Iran in a helicopter crash. It could be a helicopter crash. It was foggy. I mean, he's flying a Bell helicopter, which dates from before the 1979 revolution when America stopped exporting stuff. It sounds almost incredibly irresponsible, because Iran's been under Western sanctions since. So maybe One article I wrote said, well, the equipment on this Bell helicopter can't have been updated, and maybe that's why it was in bad shape and crashed and everything. Anyway, it amazes me that they didn't have the very latest helicopters from, I mean, Russia, if they have those contacts. The fact that the Iranians talk... Yeah, sorry.
No, I was just... Great minds think alike, Pelle. I was just thinking the same thing. Both China and Russia could have delivered modern, safer helicopters than an old Bell helicopter. And I can't really for the life of me think about why they would still be using them. But that's, once again, just speculation. From my point of view, stupidity. But there's probably an answer somewhere out there.
Unless, of course, that's not true. And they were flying. Maybe the Iranians don't want to go there and indicate that it's an assassination by talking up the fact that it was a Bell. Maybe it wasn't. But if it was, it's very strange. Unless, of course, it's an inside job. I mean, let's say there might be I don't think it is. But the one possibility is that there's an Iranian section of Iranian leadership who wants to get rid of this hardliner and replace him with someone else. And then, you know, either sponsored somebody to shoot a missile or disrupted the electronics or something. Anyway, we don't know. It's so hard. As you know, like with the Palme assassination, we're both living in Sweden. You know, 150 people have confessed to his murder, and 40 years on, still no solution. So what I could just hope is that it doesn't turn into cause for escalation anyway. So, well, that's right easy. We're going to talk about FICA. We're going to talk about perhaps other geopolitical events in this. May you live in good times. May you live in interesting times is the Chinese curse. And we are living in very interesting times. This is the Pelle Neros-Taylor Show. We're just getting into our news break, and we'll be back with Mats Nilsson, geopolitical analyst, after the break.
The news. TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with your TNT headlines. Israel's lashed out at South Africa over its genocide case in the International Court of Justice. The European Union has banned another handful of Russian media outlets. Slovakia's Prime Minister remains in a serious but stable condition after surviving last week's assassination attempt. And Poland's spending $2.5 billion on beefing up defences along its borders with Russia and Belarus.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neros-Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. Well, we pivot from one accident come assassination in Iran to a definite assassination attempt in Slovakia. The smaller of the two states that separated in 1993 when Czechoslovakia became Czech Republic and Slovakia. Mats, what do you know about that? And do you think it was a lone gunman or something else behind it? And who was Fico anyway? Who is Fico? Because he's still alive.
No, Fico is also one of these people who have been around for many years within Slovakian politics, coming and going in different positions and then ending up where he ended up. He's perceived as somewhat, you know, as a friend of Russia and someone who embraces Putin and all the rest of it. But really, when you look at what he's said politically from his own from the horse's mouth, that is Fico's mouth, he said that he doesn't accept the Crimean annexation. He doesn't accept the Russian invasion, but he also says that it's not plausible for us to keep feeding Ukraine military equipment, and Ukraine is incapable of regaining this territory by means of military force. So from there, he says, we have to negotiate. But as you know, given the times, a sensible position as the one Fico and Orban has, that meaning that diplomacy must be the way forward, is labeled as an extremist position. Diplomacy today is an extremist view, especially in Brussels. So he has been made out to be this Putin lover, which is objectively not true. And as for the preliminary investigations, such as I was doing many, many years ago when I was a young lawyer, initially I said it's a lone gunman. It's someone who was radicalized. He fit the profile somewhat. And also it came out later he was living, cohabitating with a Ukrainian woman. But then I saw something today, just a few hours ago around lunchtime, and it said that Slovakia, I think it was on the BBC, it said the Slovakian attacker may not have been a lone wolf. They are now looking for a person who helped Sintula plan the assassination. And according to the Ministry of Interior in Slovakia, 2 hours after the attack, Sintula deleted all of his posts on the social networks. Now, what the Republic's Ministry of Interior said was that, of course, Sintula himself, the suspected assassination person, couldn't have done this because he was in custody, nor could his Ukrainian wife or partner have done it. They said she wasn't able to do it either. So that means there may have been someone else who was pushing or perhaps encouraging him to commit the crime. And who was this, and was it an organized attempt? How did they find him? How did they pinpoint him? There were a lot of questions suddenly awoken by this news that came out around lunchtime today. So I have been in the camp of a lone wolf assassin, but perhaps there were people whispering in his ear and radicalizing him. It's been known to, I mean, it's the modus operandi of many FBI operations. So it's not that as if it's something new. It's been known to happen. And you even have gone as far as the Manchurian candidate theory when Bobby Kennedy was killed. So it's
you mean somebody was brainwashed or drugged or someone? Is that your the Manchurian candidate?
Yeah, exactly. Someone that's controlled. That's the step beyond encouragement. That's control. I don't think that's the situation here. But perhaps this the fact that his social media was erased, pointing to someone else being involved, is worth looking into. But so far, given the evidence, I'm still in the lone wolf camp.
Well, let's hope it was a lone wolf.
Most
famously,
definitely.
LBJ, when ringing around recruit members of the Warren Commission back in 1963, hinted, or he said, I can't remember the exact quote, but he was sort of saying, well, you know, let's find it's a lone gunman, this Lee Harvey Oswald guy, because the suspicion was that it was the Russians who did it. And the plotters who came from the CIA milieu breadcrumbed the whole Lee Harvey Oswald thing to lead it to the Russians, as if they were looking for a casus belli to attack the Russians, you know. And so these could be double games playing here, that they came from the West or the Ukrainian intelligence, and they're trying to breadcrumb it to the Russians, and then that'll allow NATO intervention or something. Anyway, I hope they'll find it a lone killer or not. But we mustn't forget that Slovakia is right next door to Ukraine. There are literally millions of Ukrainian refugees in Europe, Western Europe. Many of them are guns, many of them veterans. It's easy. We're living in a peaceful Europe side by side with a total war zone, and there will be this bleed over. You know, it's not difficult to think of, and Slovakia is on the front line. Okay, we've got 2.5 minutes left. Can you just say something about Julian Assange? Because that's sort of a good news story amid all this gloom. The High Court came with an encouraging piece of news.
No. All my friends have been asking me, what do you mean, no? What I mean is, yes, it's encouraging. Julian is given the right to an appeal. But what this also means is that it's kind of a win for Washington as well, because that means they can keep Julian in a legal limbo. Had the British courts said yes, and Julian Assange will be set free pending this negotiation or pending his appeal, then I would have been jubilant. But that's not the case, and I don't think it's going to be the case. So the case now is the British court says, yes, Julian, you have the right to appeal, but it's back to the Belmarsh prison for you, meaning that they can draw out the appeals process for maybe 1 year or 1.5 years, or up among us 2 years further. So that way, the problem is off the table. It goes into the memory hole. And Washington, they're punishing Julian right now, in corroboration with the United Kingdom. So I think this is a Pyrrhic victory if ever there was one. Yes, he has the right to appeal, but he's not free. He has to stay in Belmarsh when he does so, and the UK legal system can keep him in prison for maybe towards 2 years. And Washington is happy, London is happy, and the free people of the world are sad and
unhappy. Well, Mads Stensson, thank you very much. A geopolitical analyst talking to us from Stockholm with unfortunate news about Julian Assange. It's not as good as it seems, but we will carry on following this issue and pushing for the freeing of Julian Assange. Thanks a lot, Mads. We're on to our next guest now with Christine Hart with us from London to talk about Princess Diana and what really happened to her. Was it another assassination, now that we're talking about assassinations? Pelle Neroth's Taylor Show, and we're back after the break.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses. But there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision that this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
The mornings, that's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
Around here, bushfire is just a part of life. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. The people here all look out for each other. We're a community that does its bit to plan and prepare, to keep everyone safe. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
Pelle Neroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk, TNT.
Well, welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. The news cycle is overwhelming at the moment, and we've just had the death of the president of Iran, raising a helicopter crash. Was it an assassination? Jury is still out. Then it was an assassination attempt against Robert Fico, the Slovak prime minister. Luckily, it looks as if he's going to survive. I'm obsessed with assassinations and their political repercussions, and I've written about it. And I'm very happy to welcome a returning guest, Christine Hart, who's a journalist, private investigator, and Sunday Times best-selling author. Christine was trained by ex-MI6 officers and ex-CID officers, and has worked as a private detective for over 35 years, as well as being a very distinguished writer and journalist. Welcome to the show, Christine.
Thank you. Hi there, Pelle. How are you? Good to see you again.
I'm fine. Spring has finally arrived in Scandinavia, so we're enjoying the warm weather here. So Christine, you were a really central figure in kind of tabloid journalism, around the late 90s, early 2000s. You knew a lot of the figures. You're well connected within the intelligence community. And of course, probably the big story in the UK at that time was the death of Princess Diana. And for a while, the British press did a lot of speculation about whether it was an assassination or not. And of course, Al-Fayed, the owner of Harrods and the father of the Dodi, who was the boyfriend of Princess Diana or lover or whatever, and they both died in the same Mercedes crash in the Paris tunnel in 1997. Christ, it's almost 30 years ago now. But then that speculation has almost stopped. But what's your take, bringing in all your experiences? What do you think happened with Diana? And you could talk us through, because a whole new generation is watching this, who were scarcely born when Diana died. So it might be yesterday to you and me, but I mean, he's now history to a large proportion of our viewers.
Yes, well, I spoke to Diana, you may or may not know. I did an interview with James Hanning, the ex-Independent on Sunday editor, about that chat I had with Diana. It was a Sunday Mirror at the time. I was working for them. They were prying on her in a quite obnoxious way. They gave me her private number to ring up and to find out what was going on with her. So it was quite interesting to listen to her. She was so, you know, I've heard a lot of famous people, and Mick Jagger, for instance, has a kind of a real resonation with a lot of arrogance, you know. She was a very famous woman, and yet she had like a really kind of humble softness about her. When I heard that she had died, it was a really awful feeling, because knowing that how soft she was, I believe, you know, as you know, I've worked for all these ex-MI6 agencies that are known as MI6's commercial arm, and they are private companies, and they handle black bag stuff for the government. And I was told when I first started there years and years ago that there was a movie called Killer Elite, and it was actually based on a true story. And the Killer Elite movie is about these assassination programs and the people that do them. And of course, I don't want to speculate why Diana might have been assassinated, but there was a Russian, an ex-Russian intelligence man that came forward, and he showed a journalist a plan to assassinate one of the figures over there by shining a really bright light at the driver when they were going down a tunnel, to kind of use a bike, shine the bright light, confuse him, maybe slip him something beforehand. He goes out of control. Then, of course, the ambulance goes in there and gets the people, and if they're not dead yet, you know, administer whatever drugs and, you know, murder them. And it seemed to me strange that there was a flashing light in the tunnel before the driver went out of control. And Diana wasn't actually dead before she got to the hospital. So she was taken in an ambulance, I believe, for quite a while. It's all very suspicious, especially when she said in a memoir, if something happens to me in a car, my husband has murdered me. I mean, how much more do the public have to hear? But we're all lost in a Disneyland, and we don't believe that. And so we see it's a conspiracy theory, and except Charles washed in blood, his latest painting. And there was these four horses let loose in London with the blood down them. And people are saying that's biblical, you know, the four horses of the apocalypse let loose. I mean, we all know what's happening in the world right now. It's really ugly out there. What's happening? It's, you know.
Yeah, because Jonathan Yeo, I knew him, and I wonder if he's painted this. I don't know if you listened to the early part of my show, but there's half a devil's face in the, apart from his face, whole body being awash with blood, but there's an Easter egg, as it were, a hidden signal. You can half a devil's face left of the Charles portrait. You can see the eyes and half a nose and a mouth. And if you can join it, if you flip it on its, create a mirror image of it, and you set it side by side, the devil's face, the half a devil's face becomes whole. And it's very obvious. I mean, and you think, yeah. Well, did Jonathan Yeo do that by accident, by putting a black blob to be the eye, and then two black blobs to be the nostrils, and then half a mouth? It's very strange, you know. Maybe Jonathan knew Diana, or he wants to signal he's been in talks with Harry to do their revenge. Because I think that some of the Harry, Meghan, Charles conflict is a little bit about maybe. You know, this conflict over what happened to their mother. And it's the unspoken thing that Harry might have the capacity to dump on the whole royal family, you know, if things really get bad or tough or whatever. And He said when he was writing his memoir, Spare, I only put half the stuff in that I could have done. So it's actually rather mild in the circumstances. And you might see that as a veiled kind of blackmail, especially with Meghan, you know, pushing, prodding Harry, saying, go on, are you going to stand up for your mother's memory? You know, you can't let this happen. That's the dynamic as I read it, possibly. But yeah, no. Sorry. Yeah. You talk.
Yeah.
But this film that you said, that, can you just get, what was the name of it again?
Killer Elite. Killer Elite.
Killer Elite,
it's
okay.
It's about intelligence assassins, and they do exist. I mean, some people don't know that these private companies exist. There's Hacklight, there's KCS Limited, there's a few others. Most people have heard of Kroll. They think that's the only one. But these are run by officers that are very senior in MI6. They come out, they set up their own agencies. Sometimes they set up along Buckingham Gate. Christopher Steele was one of them. There's another company called Company X there. They hide the fact they're called Company X by calling themselves CIEX, which means company and then X. I worked for them for a while. That's Michael Oatley's firm. And they handle stuff that the government don't want to handle. They're called black bag companies. And also they're called MI6's commercial arm. And when I worked for a few of them, the work that comes through the door, if you compare them to other detective agencies, even high-end, you know, I work for a lot of CID officers, they have to make do with work from lawyers, work from private clients. But these guys in those agencies, there's nothing less than, you know, the lowest price for a job would be about 50 grand. And their work from other governments all around the world that maybe wants to spy on this one that's over here in this country or that one. It's incredibly exciting work that they do. It just made me salivate. And a lot of people don't even believe they exist, but there they are carrying out dirt grade spying. I believe Black Cube is one. Is it Black Cube, the one that spied for, but they did private work. They spied for Weinstein. Do you remember that?
No. I didn't know that, no, but... Right. Black Cube. Okay.
Yeah. The work they have is amazing. It is your dirt grade spying. It's fascinating.
Well, what kind of spying? You know, who would they spy on and how would they spy on those people?
Well, it might be, you know, say a car company, for instance, you know, one of the big ones, one of the racing car companies, you know, say leading figures there or people that, you know, representing their country. What are they doing? What are they up to? Get close to them. There's a lot of work where you have to get close to different people. So it's people that are going to hurt their country in some ways. It's interesting that these MI6 officers work for the different companies. In a way, it's like keeping relations sweet with different countries. One agency I worked for did masses of work for the Russians. I don't know if that's still going on. Of course, we're all kept in the dark over quite a few things.
Some people wonder whether, I mean, for all this worry about Third World War, in fact, the British and the Russians and the Americans all agree. I mean, they all consult with each other and and actually work behind the scenes together. I mean, we know that Burns, the head of the CIA, talks to Naryshkin, the head of the FSB or the SVR, and they meet in Istanbul to lay out the common agreements by which the conflict will be contained. And there's a kind of camaraderie between them in some ways. And what you're saying is that there might be behind the scenes a communication and even assisting each other that we don't know of anyway.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, that's from my perspective, it's encouraging because it, in my view, it'll prevent escalation, even though it is a bit of a stick shop and a performance, this idea of this conflict that's not so much of a conflict.
I think, you know, at the moment we are in a world war, and I think that, you know, the front line is Ukraine and the front line is Palestine. And I do think it will escalate. You know, I do think there are little things that are going on all over the world. I mean, they're bringing into different countries like Ireland and England, Germany, etc., a lot of immigrants over from different countries. They're encouraging, you know, come here, come here. And there's no housing. So they're building little camps. And it's all very, bizarre. Normally, if there's no space and there's homeless in these countries, why bring in from other countries? Why not make those countries better? But they encourage people to come here, and there's no space. So they're building these strange camps. I mean, it gives people a feeling, you know, being a little bit disconcerted, you know, what's happening here. It feels like a new world order takeover, for sure, some kind of left-wing new world order takeover, for sure. But what kind of left-wing? You know, these people that are implementing it, they're champagne socialists, you know, they're elite. The only person that I believe is, you know, one of the good ones when it comes to being communist and socialist is Vanessa Redgrave and her late brother, Corin. I mean, she could live in a mansion, but she chooses to live in a little house in Chiswick. But these people that are pushing for this new world order, left-wing communist new world order, they want it where there's just the, you know, the poor and then the elite. And that's the way they want to live. They don't want us driving cars. They don't want a lot of people driving cars. They just want an elite super, you know, super individual, and then the rest of us. So it's going to be unpleasant.
Well, immigration, I think there's a growing realization among people followers the alternative media is it can be weaponized. I mean, these young men coming into these United States back in Sweden back in 2015, and who I mean, here we are supporting Ukraine's right to be to control the Russians of East Ukraine, you know, and that's so politically controversial. You know, the real story is that, but why are we doing that when hundreds of thousands of young men from another culture are coming into our countries and settling? And you know, isn't that settlement, invasion, immigration? We make artificial distinctions between those things.
I think, yeah, people are scared. They didn't have it so much in Ireland. Now Ireland is having it, and they're, you know, absolutely terrified because the cultures don't really mix, you know, sometimes with different cultures and people that don't really want to come. They've just been encouraged, hey, you should come here. And so they don't really feel like being here. They don't really want to be here. And so they're just as confused. It's who's controlling it. It's not their fault. They've been manipulated. And I've noticed that they're always young men. Where's the women? Where's the children? They're always young men. And yes, I do believe the next lockdown, the next COVID, they'll be used as a police force and perhaps, you know, a military against us. And it's not, you know, it's not great. And as well, it's not their fault, of course. This is all a manipulation. It needs somebody to come in and to be somebody that can be a spokesperson between these people that are coming in and between ourselves. So we, the people, can take charge and not be so manipulated by the others, because they are, after all, child killers. You know, we've seen what they're capable of when it comes to the Palestinian children. They're not, they don't have our best interests at heart. They're actually terrifying. They would like to kill us, I believe.
Could you just return a little bit to Diana? There's this, apparently in some of the books, there's a guy called John Morgan who's was in Brisbane, which is where TNT Studio is based, and he was quadriplegic or something. He had some terrible handicap, but he managed to produce four or five books on the Diana death. And you read those and you think, well, there's he made a very good case. And then he died. Otherwise, you'd have him on the show. But he talked about the MI6 calling on a group called the Increment, who are the SAS, basically. And the SAS were some small teams of SAS men were capable of doing the dirty jobs for MI6. So it wasn't the agents themselves. And there were these men with motorbikes turning up and chasing who weren't paparazzi chasing Diana. And then one of them did a sort of like that, crossed his arms, sat in, when he saw that the crash had been successful. And then they drove off. So four or five high-speed motorbikes crowding in this Mercedes, and no one has ever traced them. And they didn't fit with the sort of scooter-type vehicles driven by the paparazzi, you know, who are not very martial. But it's a very evocative picture that this guy paints of men in black in big motorbikes chasing Diana on her last journey in life, you know, and then disappearing. And that's there the trail dies, except for there was an SAS, the wife of an SAS man, when they had a domestic quarrel, he said, oh, I was part of the kill team. And then she went to court and went to the Daily Mirror. And that was a brief story about that. And then that kind of died. So there we are now, you know, but it's so sensitive, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, this is what the movie Killer Elite is about. And, you know, for these, there's a lot of secret army. I did a lot of work around this with Northern Ireland. There was the Force Research Unit. That was a clandestine unit. There were also agents for MI6 that had witnessed the Omar bomb. And they said that the car was followed. It was observed and they knew who made the bomb. So these agents were loose in London. They rang the offices of a newspaper. I went out to meet some of them and they were threatening the British government. We'll tell everything about what you made us do, which was including assassinations. If we don't get our paid in, of course they got it. We ran a little story on it and they ended up getting the money and now they disappeared. Well, I hope they got the money and disappeared. I mean, it might have been, they just disappeared. Who knows?
Christine, fantastic to have you on. Every time we talk, you've given me a new insight into the secret state and the deep state. And it's not a risk-free operation talking to you from either of us, but especially for you. But lovely to have you on. Love to have you on again very soon. We will we have to go on to our next hour and our next set of guests. So thank you very much, Christine. Take care and have a good spring afternoon in London. Take care. This is the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We'll be back for our second hour with two guests talking about more about assassinations, more about covert operations, more about Iran and Ukraine and other jolly subjects. And Basil Valentine, our political editor, will be with us. This is the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show on a Monday afternoon.